you're building AI apps with popular models like YOLO V8 and Padam, you'll want to visit intel.com/edgeai for open source code snippets and helpful guides. Speed up development time and make sure your apps deploy seamlessly where you need it most. Go to intel.com/edgeai. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Stack Overflow podcast, a place to talk all things software and technology. I'm your host, Ben Popper, Director of Content here at Stack Overflow, joined as I often am by the illustrious editor of our blog and newsletter, Ryan Donovan. Ryan.
Yes, sir.
You brought us a great guest today. You want to set us up? Who are we going to be chatting with today?
Sure. We're going to be talking today with Ryan Dahl, who is the creator of both Node and Dino, started the whole JavaScript on the back end movement. And we'll be talking about, you know, all the ways that his Dino product has progressed, the ecosystem he's building out, taking over the world and all that.
Sweet.
Ryan, welcome to the Stack Overflow podcast.
Hey, nice to be here.
So we won't spend too much time on history, but just for folks who are listening, can you tell them a little bit about how you got into the world of software and development and what led you to creating Node.js in the first place?
Yeah, I started in math. I was in a PhD program for learning algebraic topology when I realized that all this abstract math stuff was not very relatable to what humans were actually doing, and dropped out. And over the course of a couple of years, kind of found my way into web development and then into server development. And in 2009, was really kind of thinking about how to write fast web servers when Chrome came out, and with that, the V8 JavaScript engine. And I kind of connected the dots that actually non-blocking servers and V8 would potentially be a pretty killer programming platform, and created Node.js. And yeah, that was a pretty successful project.
Yeah, it definitely seems so. I know that Node's been around for, 10, 15 years now. And then you started Dino as sort of another JavaScript server-side engine. Why start something new?
Yeah, you know, when Node was doing well and having lots of contributors around 2012, I left the project. I felt like it was on good footing. And went and worked on other stuff for a number of years. And it wasn't until 2019 or so that myself and a collaborator from the early Node days, Bert Belder, kind of got together and started working on Node projects again. We were in particular trying to take TensorFlow and bind that to Node to do data science-y, statistic-y sort of things. And found we were both pretty disappointed with the state of affairs in 2019. We're just like, you know, Node should be much better than this. So many years have passed, and it seems to be roughly in the same state that we left it in 2012. And that started a small little demo project to create a new JavaScript runtime. And that actually started getting quite a lot of attention. We started getting lots of contributors. So the idea of it was kind of TypeScript first. In 2019, it was pretty apparent that TypeScript was kind of the natural successor for larger JavaScript projects, and using Rust instead of C++ for the actual implementation. And we worked on that for a while before realizing that actually there's, you know, tens of thousands of users of this project already, and there's potentially an opportunity to build a business around this as well. So we founded the Dino company and are continuing to build the open source project. Of course, MIT licensed, like Node, like very, very free, but are also building commercial projects, kind of using that technology in other settings.
Mm-hmm. I think when V8 first came out, most people thought of JavaScript as just like client side, right? Why do you think it took off so well on the server side?
So it turns out that programming user interfaces, programming websites, is very, very similar to how you program web servers. So, you know, when you're programming a website, you might have a button and then you have an on-click handler. You get a little callback that you program some logic when that thing is triggered. That's actually pretty similar to how you program a non-blocking HTTP server. So you know, instead of having a button that gets pressed and then get a callback when some UI interaction happens, when you get a new request to the server, when you get a new connection, when a new byte of data gets sent to you, you trigger a callback. And JavaScript is just really minimal in the sense that it did not have any pre-existing I/O libraries. There was no way to write to standard out. There was no way to open sockets. There was no way to do any other I/O things. And in fact, there was actually only a single thread. So for kind of technical reasons, like adding a server onto JavaScript worked really well. And people who were programming front-end websites were able to take those same skills. And with just a small amount of additional knowledge, were able to program pretty nice web servers that could do long polling or other kind of real-time interactions. And yeah, I think there's just a large base of JavaScript users out there naturally, it being the language of the web. And so there was a lot of people who were able to take their skills and add on Node to that and suddenly become full stack developers.
So do you have a sense of the magnitude of how many people are touching these tools? I mean, is that something you can measure through open source contributions or other kinds of research? Like you mentioned when you left the project, right, you felt it was well sourced with great contributors and you could move on to something else with a friend. But how do you look at sort of the impact in the ecosystem of what you've done these days?
For Node, I mean, it's kind of hard to understate it. I mean, essentially all websites use Node in some form. Right? You know, I would say a good majority of HTTP requests that are made in the world are touching Node in some form. You know, maybe you're not using Node for the back-end infrastructure. Maybe you're using Go, but your front-end framework is certainly using Node to like bundle your JavaScript together. So it is involved with essentially all websites. I would say most professional engineers have touched Node. We don't know the exact numbers, but tens of millions of developers, I would say it is very popular. Dino is much, much smaller than that, much more nascent, but we estimate it in the hundreds of thousands of developers that are using it.
Cool. Yeah.
That's going to be cool to think about, and a little overwhelming, but so, yeah, I mean, it does seem like, you know, realizing that it's almost like web development is events all the way down, like moving some of those events to the server side makes sense. And I know when I first reached out to you all, it was because of the distributed edge network stuff, edge function stuff that Netlify was doing. You all have built a sort of edge function system for Dino. Why build that and not let individuals handle that on their own?
It's deceptively complicated. So essentially, our infrastructure is called Dino subhosting. Dino deploy is kind of one instance of this, and it is the technology that is powering Netlify edge functions. It is deceptively complicated to deal with kind of a multi-tenant system of you're running untrusted code from many thousands of people all at once, and you're trying to spin that up as quickly as possible and kind of service requests as quickly as possible. And yeah, there's definitely been a number of attempts to build this sort of infrastructure. But, you know, if you kind of go down this route a little bit, you realize pretty quickly that like it's harder than it seems. There's pretty serious security concerns. There's pretty serious performance issues that you need to worry about. You really need to worry about how fast can you respond to a request when you know nothing about it, right? A new request comes in from a random person. You might not have that code cached on the local server. You got to go fetch that code. You got to load it up into a VA isolate. You got to respond to it. Making all of that stuff work as efficiently as possible is relatively difficult. But that is the main bent of our commercial work at Dino is to build, let's call it a cloud runtime, a multi-tenant JavaScript runtime that spans data center regions, spans clouds even, and is kind of set up to handle many, many users at once.
Mm-hmm. You talked about adding kind of file I/O and WebSockets and other kind of I/O things to JavaScript. How do you, you know, in that multi-tenant, massive worldwide architecture, how do you protect from those, you know, additions being used maliciously?
We're pretty careful about what sort of things we expose to users. So there is, it depends on what system you're talking about in kind of the Netlify edge functions. There is no file system at all. In Dino deploy and Dino subhosting, there's kind of a file system, but it's read only. We do support WebSockets. WebSockets are just kind of upgraded HTTP requests. And so there's no real problem with handling those other than the fact that this is a serverless environment and isolates, VMs can be garbage collected essentially at any moment. So you don't really have any guarantees that you're going to have a persistent WebSocket connection. But being able to expose WebSockets is totally fine for us, as is kind of long-polled HTTP requests, as like HTTP requests that don't respond immediately. And yeah, I guess part of what we're trying to do with Dino deploy is kind of find the new abstraction layer at which you can do servers. So I think one pretty obvious abstraction layer is Docker containers, right? Every server is a container, and this is kind of the Linux abstraction layer, right? You write a Linux program, maybe in Go, maybe in Node. You put it in a Docker container, but you're effectively programming against Linux syscalls and most likely in an x86 architecture. That is, in my opinion, a very useful abstraction layer. And obviously, like, you know, there's all sorts of infrastructure built on top of that. But I think there's a higher abstraction layer that's starting to emerge where, you know, you as an application developer, you as a backend programmer that's just implementing some app, like you don't really care about Linux. Like you don't care about Linux syscalls. You don't care about systemd. There's just all sorts of stuff that is present in at kind of the Docker container, the Linux container abstraction level that is effectively unnecessary details for most developers. And what we're trying to do is kind of raise the bar here to something that is not necessarily as general purpose, right? You're not going to use this thing to build a database or you're not going to use this for all sorts of things, but this kind of JavaScript abstraction layer where it's not necessarily running on Linux, right? There isn't necessarily a file system. It's kind of a higher abstraction layer where you can do fewer things, but you can do them more easily. Yeah, I guess I think of it as kind of a post-Unix future. Is there kind of an emerging abstraction layer that is not Unix that potentially we can program against in the future, but much more rapidly?
Yeah.
And I think the jury's still out, right? These are emerging products right now. And, you know, Netlify Edge Functions, Dino Deploy, Dino Subhosting, Cloudflare Workers is definitely part of this ilk. Are all kind of trying to figure this out, and it seems like a good idea, but it's still very much under development.
It seems the way of all development is that you either go up in abstraction, you're just making, you know, CRUD apps or whatever, or you go down to the bare metal. And like, I think differentiating those more and more is probably pretty helpful for developers.
Yeah.
So Ryan, you mentioned you also have another project that you're working on, JSR, which is an alternative to NPM. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Dino in general is attempting to level up JavaScript. So I don't know how much you all are kind of living in the JavaScript ecosystem. But like I said, when we started Dino, we really found ourselves in a world that hasn't changed over many, many years. And part of what we're trying to do with Dino is really kind of level up the system. So, you know, not to get too technical here, but for example, the whole CommonJS versus ESM module system problem is really annoying for many, many developers. Like, you know, maybe if you're just building a website, you're not really exposed to this, but there's all sorts of complexity in the fact that JavaScript effectively has two different independent module systems that do not play well with each other. One called CommonJS, which, you know, largely Node invented in kind of the early 2010s, and ECMAScript modules, ESM, which is a standard defined by TC39 and now kind of embedded into all of the web browsers, the real way of doing modules. And Node has been very slow at adopting ESM. There's also kind of the conversion from JavaScript to TypeScript going on, and a number of other initiatives. JavaScript is unlike other languages, right? It is, in some sense, the most important programming language because it is inherent in the web. It is kind of like a protocol in some ways, right? You can think of it on similar footing to HTTP or CSS or HTML. Like, it is definitely not going away tomorrow, right? JavaScript is, there's all sorts of human infrastructure built on top of this stuff. And because of that, like, JavaScript needs to evolve. Like, JavaScript is, it is not like, let's say, Ruby, which, you know, may very well just disappear, right? Like, there's, you know, obviously a bunch of stuff built on top of Rails, but it's not inherent to civilization in the same way that JavaScript is. So, it, you know, it's incumbent on us as developers to really move this ecosystem into the future. And Dino is trying to do this at the runtime layer, but what we perceive is really a problem at the registry layer where you share code. NPM itself, it has been very successful, has millions of published modules on it and a great resource for any developer. But it has effectively stopped evolving many, many years. Like, in the last 5 years, there has been essentially zero feature development in NPM. I think the newest feature they added was like 3 years ago when they added the files tab to the package website. So you could like browse the files that are in packages before you see them. I mean, it's just very, very slow. And this is just insufficient for the world's default programming language. So what we are working on is a project called JSR. It's at jsr.io. It stands for JavaScript Registry. And it is a modern place to publish your JavaScript or TypeScript code. And it is much better. It is it is like much, much better in many, many ways. You know, despite this being me contrasting this with NPM, there are real network effects around the NPM ecosystem. And we are not trying to replace NPM wholesale. JSR is meant to be an extension of NPM. So JSR packages can depend on NPM modules. In some sense, you can think of it as a superset of NPM, kind of in the same way that TypeScript itself is a superset of JavaScript.
Yeah, that's interesting because my sense is that NPM sort of evolved organically and was a little bit of an ad hoc process. But, you know, anytime I hear about, a lot of times when I hear about some sort of breach or issue, it's that somebody took over an NPM module and it wasn't, you know, they injected some code into it. And suddenly everybody who has that package is exposed.
There are a number of very concerning security problems with NPM. You know, there are, for a very long time, they did not even keep checksums of NPM packages. And there have been instances where hackers have gotten into the registry and potentially changed tarballs that were published. And there is no way to know because there is no checksum of those tarballs. There's all sorts of supply chain security problems beyond hackers literally getting into the registry. You can accept a pull request from some random person and it may inadvertently inject some code into your package. JSR has security features, modern security thoughts around this that attempt to, you know, you can never 100% say that some code uploaded by a random person on the internet is going to be safe, but we can give more visibility into this. And we do this in particular with a system called SigStore. So the way this works is often you build your package on GitHub through GitHub Actions. And what we can do is get an OpenID Connect token from GitHub, from your actions, so that we know that this GitHub user ran these commands to produce this package, and we can get a cryptographic signature of that package. And on the JSR side, we can publish that signature to the SigStore blockchain that keeps a persistent log of all of these packages. And so while we can't say for certain that this package, you know, is security free, what we can do is say, you know, Ben published this package at this date. These are the commands he ran. As long as you trust GitHub, like we can at least say that. Maybe GitHub got hacked. Maybe Ben gave his password to somebody. Like we can't say everything about it, but we can at least say that, guys. Like, yeah, it happens. So anyway, we can do these kind of cryptographic attestations, as they're called, of where packages got built and publish them in the package pages and just kind of expose these details to users. And, you know, what you would hope is that, you know, if in the future there is a problem that is discovered with some package, that you can go back and look at the record, or, you know, lack of the record maybe is a signal that you shouldn't use the package. But you can go look back at the record and at least go back through the steps and say, okay, well, Ben published it at this date. You know, I guess we should sue him, or like, I don't know. It just gives you a record of like where this code right. is coming from. And that is important for trust, right? It's building up a web of trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it seems like the sort of like chain of commits that like GitHub publishes naturally, right?
Yes.
Right. To make sure that you know exactly who's touched it. When, yeah.
And in some ways, it's an extension of signed commits. Yeah.
Ryan, I'm trying to recall. I feel like we had somebody on the podcast not too long ago who was trying to expand on the SigStore model. Maybe it has something to do with blockchain.
Yeah, I think we had somebody who was related to SigStore.
Yeah, I mean, beyond the SigStore stuff, Dino has security features itself. So V8 is a secure sandbox, and we do not allow people necessarily to touch the file system or make network connections. Kind of by default, you are in a JavaScript sandbox without the ability to reach out of it. And so, you know, unlike in NPM and in Node, where if you NPM install a module because of like post-install hooks, You are literally running untrusted code, unaudited code from the internet. Like, it is super dangerous to NPM install something. And you are, the only way that you are not getting hacked at every moment is just through random trust of random people on the internet. Like, it's a very bad situation. In Dino, we gate all of these accesses. You cannot open a random connection to a random web server just willy-nilly. Like, you need to give the permissions to make outbound connections. In the same way that web browsers, not every website can like open up your camera and start taking photos, right? Like, you have to give permissions to allow the website to do that. These are, in my mind, like very obvious next steps for server-side JavaScript. Like, it needs to act more like web browsers are. And like, security is a main concern, because what we're really talking about is untrusted code from the internet. You need to think about it. Think carefully about that.
Mm-hmm. I've got it here now. It was Craig McLuckey, who's the co-founder of Kubernetes. He started a new company called Stacklock. And again, I think a lot of their reason to exist was their frustration, similar to you, Ryan, with all of the security issues on NPM and the fact that, you know, people tend to just trust it because it's the easiest solution. But, you know, really, it's creating a lot of harmful weaponized packages and supply chain issues, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I don't know the exact details of Stacklock, but like in Kubernetes, like the hope is that you can kind of take these package attestations really far. So we can verify that Ben ran these commands to create this package. Those are published alongside your package in JSR. At the end of the day, you're going to take a number of dependencies and build your microservice and then publish that probably as a Docker, you know, run that as a Docker container in some Kubernetes infrastructure. And it would be very nice. And Kubernetes is starting to have tooling around this. And my guess is that that's what Stacklock is working on, to be able to say all software running inside this Docker container has attestations that trace it all the way back to a verified user somewhere. And that, like, there is no code that is running here that we don't know where it came from, right? Like, all the code traces back somewhere. And that would be very nice, like especially if you're a big enterprise and you have very serious security concerns, like you kind of want, just from a compliance angle, to be able to say, hey, we know who wrote the code on that we are running right now.
It's coming back to me now. Yeah. There's like a cryptographic signing and a transparent ledger and an open set of logs and, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. You know, in the future, we're kind of building up the infrastructure for this. And what likely will happen is in the future, every microservice will have clear attribution for all of your dependencies, right? And that's very nice. Then you have really mitigated the supply chain risk.
Yeah, I think, you know, the open source movement has been wonderful in a lot of ways, but it's also made people very aware of their code supply chain and dependency issues, just because every website is built by a village now.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, on one hand, like you can go pick up utilities, you know, for free that do very powerful things. But on the other hand, like, where did that come from? You have no possibility of auditing all of the code that's in your stack anymore. It's just too big. So yeah, you kind of really need these systems like Sigstore.
So JSR, what sort of stage is it? And how do people hook into it when it's ready?
Yeah, so it just launched like 2 weeks ago. So I would say it's very early in its efforts. JSR, it's really important. I think there's a lot of confusion because there's a lot of package managers in the NPM ecosystem. But this is not a package manager. This is a registry. So you can still use Yarn. You can still use NPM. You can still use PNPM. You can use your kind of existing package manager, but connect it to this new registry. And so if you have, I don't know, say a Remix website, you can pull down JSR packages and integrate that into your website, despite the fact that you use Yarn and kind of existing package managers. So there's no need to kind of flip all of your infrastructure around. It's kind of only benefits. These packages that you get from JSR all have kind of proper DTS files, TypeScript declaration files. So you'll get proper inline documentation in your editor and IntelliSense and all of those great things. JSR kind of ensures that the packages that get published there are modern and kind of doing best practices. I guess I should also mention that JSR is, unlike NPM, is completely open source. The back end, the front end, the whole thing is open sourced and MIT licensed. And I mentioned that we have the Dino company that is, of course, a for-profit business. JSR is not part of our commercial operations. JSR is for the JavaScript community, right? It is an attempt to level up JavaScript, and it's designed to be able to run very cheaply on commodity cloud software. So we have no problem paying for this in the short term, but you know, if JSR doesn't crash and burn and persist, which I think it has a good chance of doing, I think it's pretty good software. We would eventually like to have this thing be in a foundation and kind of operating independently. We're trying to build an institution here for kind of the future of JavaScript.
Cool. I'm sure there's plenty of foundations out there. I can think of a couple, two, three that would do well to pick it up. So, Ryan, what do you think is the future for the JavaScript ecosystem? Do you think it'll be more in the back end, more frameworks? Do you think JavaScript itself will start changing more?
I think the future for JavaScript is, first of all, there is definitely a future for JavaScript because it's so deeply embedded into web browsers. Like it's definitely not going away anytime soon. And unlike many other technologies in the world, I feel confident saying that JavaScript will be here 5 years from now, if not 10. If not 20 years from now. Like it is like your bank depends on JavaScript. Like it is not going away anytime soon. Right. And I think the future of JavaScript is browsers. Like browsers will always dictate the future of JavaScript. And so any server-side code must narrow the gap to browser JavaScript. And hence our efforts to push forward ECMAScript modules versus CommonJS modules, things that I invented in 2010 for Node.js, are just not where browsers are going now. And I think there's a real need to close the gap between browsers. Beyond that, I think TypeScript is very, very useful. It has clear utility. It is so successful because it's been so restrained in what it has developed. It's really just a superset of JavaScript with types added onto it. And I think this is likely to be codified in standards, you know, maybe not this year or next year or the year after, but I think over time, TypeScript will kind of find its way into the standards and really become part of what JavaScript is.
All right, everybody. It is that time of the show. We want to shout out someone who came on Stack Overflow, shared a little knowledge, maybe a little curiosity. A great question badge awarded to Squadron 9 hours ago for asking a great question that's got a score of 100 or more. I want to wrap all the nodes within my slides container div with JavaScript. I know I could do it in jQuery, but I want to know how to do it with pure JS. Well, if you want to do that as well, we've got an answer for you, and we've helped 161,000 people. So appreciate the question, Squadrons. I am Ben Popper. I am the director of content here at Stack Overflow. Find me on X at Ben Popper. Hit us up with questions or suggestions for the show, podcast at Stack Overflow. And if you enjoy the program, leave us a rating and a review.
I'm Ryan Donovan. I edit the blog here at Stack Overflow. You can find it at stackoverflow.blog. And if you want to reach out to me, I'm on X at @RThorDonovan.
I am Ryan Dahl. I am working on Dino. You can find it at dino.com, and you can find JSR that I mentioned here at jsr.io. I don't have a Twitter, but you can find my blog at tinyclouds.org.
Sweet. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you soon.